This episode is one of the first in a series of special segments from some of our episodes about the topics of career, parenting, and spirituality. The purpose of this podcast from the beginning has always been to bring you the wisdom of mentors to be able to help you learn from their journeys and their mindset and their perspectives and their purpose to be able to create a better life for yourself. So this series is yet another tool for you in that exact same direction. So get ready, listen in, take some notes, and identify for yourself what do you want to change in your life in order to make your life even better for you. Let's begin. Here's Dina Kaplan from episode 28. Well, that's an important point, right? I mean, I'll ask you more about benefits of meditation, but maybe also through this question. Like, you obviously got completely burnt out when you're back as a tech founder and you were doing all this stuff to make millions and didn't make a single cent. But you're working your ass off and clearly you're spinning your wheels, but you weren't getting that much traction. And what would you have done differently now if you had the skills you have today, but you found yourself still COO at Blip TV?
Good memory. Thank you for listening. Everyone says I come from the corporate world. Like, it's a startup, not the corporate world. So thank you for listening. I wouldn't say we didn't get much traction. We got huge traction. We built a top 50 website in the world. We raised about $40 million. We had, I think it was 300 million video views a month. I think that was the metric. We built a big site. It was definitely a big site and a real company. I wouldn't say that we were spinning our wheels and not having traction at all, actually. But maybe what you're saying is that I'm not very new age, but now I'm going to say something new age, so forgive me. I didn't hold my center in that time. I mean, I would say what I didn't do was be successful at being myself. I was very right. much playing a role. So I know I've actually thought about that. If I were in that role right now, I would hire someone excellent underneath me who would handle all my emails. Just boom, take that off so that working, quote unquote, working would not equate to answering emails. I wouldn't be allowed to do that. I would have to be proactive. And I had someone under me, but my co-founder wouldn't let me fire her. It was like a whole mess, but I would have stood in my power. And I would have actually said we had all these people that wanted to buy the company and those huge companies that all of us would know those names. Make an offer and my co-founder would say, oh, no, sorry, we're waiting for the $1 billion exit. So we would say no to a $240 million offer or something in the hundreds of millions. So I would have spoken up for myself. I need a team. We were at this point in the company where there were five co-founders and whatever, X number of managers, all the managers of the different departments. I was the only manager that was running seven departments by myself: business development, finance, accounting, on and on, PR, et cetera, et cetera, HR. I was running all that without a single direct report. So I would have demanded a team. I would have demanded to have, like I said, someone under me that was handling all of the reactionary work, or most of it. And I would be proactive in terms of thinking strategically for the company. And I would have said to sell the company, right? It'll be in the book. You'll be the first to know, Harry, because I haven't written about this or talked about this before. But with all these offers, I would have said, we have five founders of this company. We're 7 years in. We are exhausted. Let's make some money and get out of it and move on to the next win. And then I probably would have gone and become a big VC at one of the big venture capital firms, because at the time, it was definitely one of the most prominent women founders in the country, if not maybe the most, certainly on the coast of the United States. So I would have had a lot of opportunities there to move on to venture, maybe even private equity. I don't think I would have been as happy as I am now, so I'll still count my successes more, but I would have done a much better job of playing the role of being myself.
And how did you end up being the only one of the founders or the only one of the directors who was basically taking on more load than anyone else? How did that happen?
Taking on more and the only one without a full staff underneath me.
Right.
Yeah, it was insecurity. It was people pleasing. I have this very strong people pleasing side that comes from having been bullied. We didn't have that word back then when I was growing up, and being bullied really badly as a little kid, and telling myself as a little tyke at summer camp after being bullied for a whole summer, I will never be the reject again. I want to hone my personality so finely that I will be popular for the rest of my life. And that became the goal. I wrapped my whole personality around this goal of being liked. And by the way, that worked great. I mean, in terms of that was successful for me in high school, successful for me in college, successful for me in many ways until I co-founded a company. And you cannot be people pleasing and manage because I am smart in the sense that I know when people are not doing a good job at their job. So the people, let's say I hire someone to do social media for us and they're not doing a good job, I cannot tell them that because I still want them to like me. And that is more important than that person doing a good job. So they would know they're not doing a good job, but I couldn't say it. And there was that cognitive dissonance where they knew that I thought something, but I wasn't, my words didn't match what my publicly expression was conveying. And it made everyone uncomfortable. So I lost a lot of power within the company. I was very popular outside the company, very unpopular in the company. Because over time, spending a lot of time with someone who's not authentic is jarring. It's kind of yucky. Like, we'd probably all rather be with someone who has a really abrasive personality. If you think of your kind of typical New Yorker from the films or TV, we'd probably all rather be with that person than with someone who says one thing and does another. Like, they say something, but you know it's not authentic. I think people, my co-founder of The Path, actually, who now lives in Australia, and I think he runs a meditation studio there, Charlie Knowles, he says people crave authenticity, and I think he's right about that.
Mm. I mean, like, especially with what you were sharing before about you needed people to hear you and listen to you. And if you're not being authentic, you're not saying what you're actually thinking, and then there's no way that they're going to hear you either way. You're just shooting yourself in the foot. You're setting yourself up for failure. Is Priya Nathaki from episode 40.
What was one of, like, the first kind of career focused decisions you made after dance, or what led you to leaving dance? I assume you're not still a professional dancer, I'm guessing.
Unfortunately, I do still support students in their learning. Whenever my mom actually runs a large dance school, and so when she needs support, I still support with choreography and some student things. But actually, I left performance because I actually had an injury, which was very severe, and I couldn't continue the same way I had. The performance practice rigor was almost 6 to 8 hours a day you have to practice, and it was just too much on the injury to try to recover and also maintain the schedule and also be traveling for performance. So I left dance because of an injury, like many professional athletes, tend to at some point undergo some sort of injury usually. But that's kind of why I left dance. And I think part of growing up in this way, knowing that the world is an endless amount of choices, I had never thought that dance would be my only career. I truly believed, like, as early as probably 5 or 6, I believed that I'm going to have like 4 full-time careers because I can do everything. And my parents really supported that idea. But by contrast, what was very interesting was the Indian community right around the age of 16, 17-ish. The Indian community, we have these little get-togethers, at people's homes, and like a lot of Indians come and we eat dinner and we hang out. And it always ends up that any kind of teenage, almost college going person is sort of, kind of trapped by all these, we call them aunties and uncles. They're basically, community members that we They're not real aunties and uncles, yeah, but we call them aunties and uncles, and we treat them with that sort of respect. And so they kind of crowd around you and trap you on a couch or somewhere, and they're like, "What are you going to do for college? And you know, what are you going to be? And you know, did you do your apps? And da 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 da." And like every last little question that they could possibly ask, and they, you know, want to all be involved and make sure you're going to do everything right and everything's fine, right? And I remember this one party that happened, this little dinner party that happened. And there was this one auntie, and I remember sitting on this brown couch. It was this overly soft brown couch. And we were sitting there, and this auntie had so much, like, so much concern and so much, like, good intention. And she was sitting there, and she was like, "You know, Priya, like, we know you've grown up very famous and all this kind of stuff. And, you know, though, that, like, when you go to college, you know, it'll be too demanding. You're going to have to give up all this dance and everything. Right? You're going to have to pick some, just one thing, you know, you can't do all of this and then also be successful there." And of course, like in that moment, I can tell you, I didn't go to a very energizing place, right? In that moment, I was like, "Who the hell are you to tell me I can't do something?" Right? Like in that moment, I just felt so much like resistance. You know, I could feel that resistance within me. I was like, "No, like, I don't believe that. Like, that is not real. That is not true. Like, my own parents aren't telling me that. Like, who are you to tell me that? Who are you to put a cap on what I can be or what my choices are? Hell no." Right. And, but of course I didn't show any of that. Being a very skilled dancer, was able to keep that all inside. And I said, "You know, auntie, I don't know, like, I really appreciate you, you know, bringing it up, and it's something I'll think about." And, I remember that night just making that decision of like, no way, like, I'm going to show this whole community, especially this auntie, wrong. Like, that's a wrong belief that should not be shared with other people. And I'm going to prove that belief wrong. And so I had already decided, at that age that, and in that time, being so influenced by my brother and, you know, in the '80s, there wasn't a lot of resources, and facilities and, you know, things like that, like communities, not so much facilities, but communities for adults with Down syndrome. And so I had decided that I'm going to be a doctor, and that I was going to open this large center for Down syndrome in various parts of the world, with the headquarters being in India, for people, adults with Down syndrome, because there were some resources for kids. But
was this before or after? Sorry, was this before or after your injury that took you out of dance?
This was before my injury. Yeah, this was right around 16, 17. My injury happened at about 25, 26. Okay. So,
was that before or after your brother passed away?
And my brother passed away when I was 34.
Okay.
Yeah. So, just to give the chronology of it. Each of these was like 10 years apart, you know, this moment. And so at that moment, I had already decided, you know, I'm going to do this thing and I'm going to build this thing. And actually at the time, my vision was my brother could be, you know, one of the key people in that place. And by the time I get it going, he'll be an adult and he could run some programs and things. You know, I like figured in some roles for him and all that. I'm pretty sure he wouldn't have agreed to any of those roles because that wasn't his mode of succession. I had thought about all that and I went on, you know, I was on that achiever's path, right? Like, I was recruited out of high school by a university. I went to university. I finished everything. Like, I finished high school in 3 years. I finished 2 degrees of college in 3 years. I finished 2 master's degrees in a year. And so I was just on this mission to get to that dream as quickly as possible, right? I got into medical school, took the MCAT, studied everything, got into medical school, deferred for a year because I wanted to learn the business because I was like, oh, I'm going to open the center. Like, it's not going to cut it for me just to know how to be a doctor. I'm going to have to also know the administrative side and all that. And in that journey of learning all that administrative side and all that, I realized, oh, I don't think I really want to, like, it's not just about the Down syndrome community. It's about healing people. It's about giving people possibility, right? I used to believe that the best way to give people possibility was you take away anything that's distracting them. And one of the biggest distractions is any health issues, right? If you have a health issue, you're not really thinking about the possibilities. You're just trying to fix your health issue. it's very, very challenging, you know? And so I naively used to believe that if you solve someone's health issue, then obviously, like, they will then, you know, have this beautiful emotional home and they'll make possibilities and, you know, nothing else is needed. We just remove this physical barrier and boom, it just connects, right? Well, you know, I was like 16, so I didn't quite get that's not how it really works.
You can get people out of a hole, but that doesn't put them at the top of the mountain.
Here's Abby Gates from episode 30.
You know, there's, now that you say that, so I worked for a startup years ago, and, you know, it was very clear that we were struggling with, you know, how we were positioned in the marketplace. Like, I don't know that our platform was as mature as we led our clients to believe. And, you know, we invested a lot of time and energy into hiring all of these people to join the team to support this platform that, you know, was very clearly not hitting the mark. And then on top of it, it was very clear that we were going to have to, you know, readjust our go-to-market strategy, which meant, you know, different sales targets or different sales audiences, rather, different sales profiles. So were we going to go direct selling or partner selling? Like, it was very clear in this town hall meeting that we were struggling mightily to meet the demands of our clients. And then I felt that our entire employee team could see this. Like, it was very clear to me, you know, we are being sold, you know, snake oil here. And so I said, you know, I think I said something to the effect of, this doesn't make any sense at all. Like, none of this really lands in a way that makes any sense to any of us here. You know, something to that effect, like absolutely calling this out, you know, and I remember having a conversation with our chief product officer after the fact, and I think he was surprised by this. And, you know, nothing came of it, but, you know, I think, you know, thereafter half the company was laid off, you know, within the next month. And so, you know, there was some like sense of validation I felt in the moment, but, you know, at the time it was, what was I hoping to glean from all of this? Like, mm-hmm. what happens here? If I say this thing, it doesn't change anything. You know, it's created confusion. It's now, you know, shined a spotlight on this, you know, big glaring miss in our organization, but it doesn't create opportunities for collaboration. It doesn't put people in a mindset to say, you know, we've got this, you know, big problem in front of us. How do we solve our way out of it? How do we create these opportunities to create a win here for everyone? You know, it was just me.
If you were able to go back into that moment now, and you're at this town hall, and like, you know, everything that you know now, right? You've already got you've got the additional years, or maybe decade of wisdom and experience now, and parenting and leadership experience as well. And you go back into that moment and you're going to do something, maybe. What do you, you're about to get up and go, we're selling snake oil and this is terrible. And you're lying to everybody and this is horrific and this is unfair. And you're about to get up and do something. What would you do?
You know, I'd like to think, you know, with a decade of wisdom under my belt, you know, I'd like to think, you know, if I were to stand up and ask a question that's, you know, how can we as a team move forward? What are we in a position to do today in order to do X, Y, and Z? You know, something that was more solution oriented instead of being someone that very clearly is good at identifying a problem. But that doesn't do any good. You know, the only way out of this is through it. Mm-hmm. How can we meet the moment? You know, how can I, you know, because what I've realized now with my role is it is my job. You know, I often say to CEOs that I work with and for, you know, it is not my job to understand the vision. I amplify it. My mm-hmm. entire role here is to amplify exactly what we've settled on as our mission. What are we trying to deliver here? And how are we trying to deliver those items? Like, what's our, you know, sort of value-based system in doing that? And so in doing this now, I'd like to think I would look at it through the lens of, you know, how can I create a solution-oriented call to action to the people of this company? Because they look to me to be someone who's sort of the heartbeat of the organization. You know, I'm sort of this live wire of emotion in that way of sort of, you know, being very attuned to how people are feeling and how can we capitalize on you know, feelings of fulfillment, of satisfaction, of you know, impact, of feeling like we're doing this great work, but also doing my best to make sure that we hear and validate those who are feeling frustration, of concern, but reframing those things in a way that still puts us on the right track.
Here's Chelsea Pottinger from episode 33.
But when I was young, I was big into basketball and I had some rejection along the way. You know, I remember I didn't make this under 16s basketball state tryout team and I was devastated. I was playing alongside Lauren Jackson. So that was the caliber of player I was competing up against. No pressure, everyone.
No pressure. You should definitely judge yourself for not doing well enough.
Yeah, definitely. Totally. And, I remember I didn't make this team and Loz made it and we went home together in the car because we grew up in Albury together. And I called my coach and I was devastated and I was crying because at 16, you feel like that's your whole destiny, right? Like, I'm meant to be playing in the NBA. Like, why didn't I make this team? And I called my coach and he said to me, you know what, Charles, you're just not good enough yet. That's the truth. So you've got 6 months to turn this around to make, you know, this the state teams that can compete with the Australian junior teams. So if you want to do this, I'll train you at 5 a.m. every morning before school in Albury. Now, Harry, do you know how cold it gets in Albury winter? It's freezing, right? Mm-hmm. Down there. I'll train you at 5 a.m., Chelsea. Let's change your diet. Let's put you on some creatine, which is what they used to do back then, right, to bulk us up in the gym. And let's get you lifting differently in the gym, lifting weights. And 6 months from now, you might just make that Australian junior team. And that was such a driving force for me because he was bang on, right? Like, I wasn't good enough yet, but with a different approach, I definitely could be. And so I trained hard and I did everything he told me to do for the next 6 months. And 6 months later, I actually made that team. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I was like the second draft pick and, you know, obviously Lauren Jackson was number one and I'm okay being her number two girl for sure in that team. But that was such a pivotal moment for me because it taught me about hard work and it taught me about discipline and it taught me about how to overcome failure. And when you're a founder, these skills are exceptionally helpful. And when I started EQ Minds, you know, I was in this scenario where I was doing it all by myself for the first 3 years. You wear every single hat and it's enormously hard. And from a strategic, you know, decision, from tech, from marketing, business generation, all those kinds of things, you need discipline and you need grit and you need fierce independence. And those were skills that I learned from high-level basketball, for sure.
Here's Niti Nataraja from episode 14.
Yeah, look, I hear everything which you're just saying there. And this might be, before we continue with your journey, it might be an interesting point to discuss a bit. Because, I mean, I guess a lot of people who are listening to this will be thinking, sure, but you're still working at a tobacco company. You've been really successful at the tobacco company. On top of being really successful there, like, obviously you only rise up in the company when you're doing exceptional work for them. And I doubt that the tobacco company was really keen on you enforcing ethics, I guess. So the argument would be that then, in some ways, you've supported the industry to continue to progress. And I'm playing a little bit of devil's advocate here because you know me well enough that I believe mostly in personal responsibility rather than corporate responsibility, but they obviously both play their part. And I'm curious how you've managed to balance the ethics because it's not what you're passionate about. You're more passionate about mental health and equality and a business that's, yeah.
No, it's a good question, and I think one of the things that really helped me reconcile that for myself was the fact that actually, as an organization, they were investing a lot in R&D and in innovation to try and move away from cigarettes. Now, you can be cynical, I guess, about the fact that a tobacco company is doing that and say, well, you know, what does that really mean? And isn't there just some other angle here and it's another product, et cetera? But I think for me, I think the fact that they were moving into this different area and trying to move people off cigarettes and into something that was or is scientifically shown to be less harmful to people, far less harmful, like up to 95% less harmful to people than smoking, that is a positive, right? And that was what they were trying to do. Is and I think the thing is, you know, people are cynical about this and they say, well, you know, shouldn't you then just, you know, stop selling the product that's really harmful? Like, why wouldn't you just, if you really cared about this, you just stop selling cigarettes, right? And it's easy to say that, but all that happens is you create a black market, right? So if you actually want to get rid of the product to begin with, you can't go down the road of prohibition. You can't go down the road of not, just not selling. You actually have to have an alternate thing for them to transition to or move to, so that once they've transitioned enough people, then you can say, okay, we'll get rid of that, right? And so for me, I think this story and the fact that there were these, you know, these other things happening behind the scenes, that was what allowed me to get comfortable in working for this company, because a lot of my work was in that area of trying to facilitate change and see how we could try and move Australia down that track. And so even for the last couple of years, that's, you know, a lot of what I worked on was more to do with therapeutic goods type regulation rather than tobacco itself, because it was about trying to work out how you can get these products out there and start moving people away from smoking.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Cool. And that sounds well reasoned. I'm sure there are people who are listening who would still be like, nah, you still work for a tobacco company, but I guess everyone's entitled to their opinion, right?
Yeah, exactly. And I think this is the thing, right? Like, you know, and I know there's a lot of stigma attached to it, and I've dealt with that over the years, right? Like, you know, it's not necessarily being comfortable, you know, voicing where you work in every type of situation, right? And I've had these conversations with people over the years around, you know, how could you work there, and you know, how does that mean that you're aligned, and how can you say that you care about XYZ if you're also working at this company? But I don't think they're mutually exclusive, right? Mm. You know, when it comes to the point around ethics and, you know, whether or not the company cared about ethics, I actually think they did, and they have lots of policies and stuff that go far beyond regulation, you know. So it's not just what's out there in black and white in legislation, but it's actually the policies they have themselves and how they use those policies to frame what they do as a business. So, you know, and people will be cynical about that, 100%. And I can't do anything about the fact that people are cynical, you know. Mm. Like, it's not for me to change someone else's mind about what they think about me having worked for a tobacco company, you know. That was part of my story. It's part of my journey. It's a decision I made at a point in time for a number of reasons, right? And do you know what? They treated me well. I did a lot of interesting work. I learned a lot about myself. All the stuff I'm now really interested in and the stuff that I really am passionate about started off in this organization with me starting to work on inclusion and diversity efforts, with me starting to work on mental health programs, with me starting to work on, you know, flexibility related topics. And so they all had their birth within this organization. Sure, I might have cared about these things before, but, you know, I became a mum whilst I was working at this company. So my experiences around flexibility are framed by reference to my experiences at Philip Morris, right? Mm-hmm. At the end of the day, you know, whatever product a company sells, they're also a group of employees and people, you know, with people related issues. And what I do for a living is only one part of who I am, right? You know, it's, yes, I was a lawyer, yes, I worked at Philip Morris, but that doesn't define who I am as a person. You know, and yes. So all the other things that I care about, all the other things that I believe in, make me who I am, right? And so that's, I think, what people need to see is, you know, the whole person, not just the title and the place that you worked.
So I hear what you're saying, and I really respect it as well. There's always room for disagreement, but it sounds like you've made your point is you made the decision for what you needed. with a whole bunch of various factors which you really need to consider for yourself, for your family, for your own ethics, as well as for what the company is doing. And you made the decision for yourself that felt right at the time.
Yeah.
And it sounds like what you're sharing as well is that the main reason that the tobacco companies are doing a lot of change is because of all the regulation that's being imposed upon them, which isn't necessarily the case with a lot of other industries as well. Here's Sarit Vandegraaff, episode 5. Okay, and so back to your journey. You started talking about, you got to the point where you just became awestruck by having a coaching conversation, and then you loved this whole idea of coaching, and it's, you realize that's what I want to do. That's what I'm going to do for my career or for this next phase. I know I'm passionate about this. And you transitioned to an in-house coach at BT. And what happened next?
So I was very fortunate. BT Financial Group was a huge supporter of my aspirations. And I think it was definitely a win-win. And, you know, they invested in me as much as I invested in being a loyal employee, essentially. And so I was subsidized. It was paid for by the organization, which I'm really still very thankful for and really appreciative of the organization for doing that. And I brought my knowledge back to the organization. So at the time, I was an internal coach, and there was a team of coaches who were working with team leaders within our customer relations department. And I essentially brought that community of coaches together and helped them grow in their own coaching skills and helped them understand what coaching was and wasn't, and put together a bit of a tracker to help them coach the people in the customer relations department, and also supported the leaders to become coaches themselves. And so that you know, bringing in that knowledge base was really useful for the organization as well. And it was useful for me as well, because I could practice, and I ended up coaching quite a few people within the organization, even outside of the department, who just heard that I was there and approached me to coach them. And so that really helped me practice quite a lot and get into the coaching, I guess, immerse myself in coaching and become more comfortable with it, probably sooner than otherwise.
And then what happened? So you did that for a few years?
I did that for a few years. So I was probably, I mean, I worked for BT for 13 years. So I was there for quite a while. I was an employee and then a leader for quite a long time, and then became an internal coach probably around 2010. And it was probably 2013 that I was approached by a wonderful woman who's still someone who I really admire and consider a friend and a leader. And her name is Karen Barker. And she is the CEO and founder of Tranexec Leadership Development. She and I actually met at a coaching course, and we ended up having to coach each other post course, and I coached her, and I think she saw a bit of potential, I suppose, at that point. And so she approached me and asked me if I would come and work with her. She was on the precipice of growing her organization. She's had it for quite a few years at that stage. And one of her big clients was engaging her in quite a lot of work, and she needed some help. So she asked if I was interested. And actually at the time, it was a little bit soon for me. My youngest was quite young, and I was very risk averse at the time as well. I needed my stability and my superannuation, my sick leave, my annual leave. So I was a little bit hesitant at the time, although the idea was really attractive to me. And I guess that's the whole balance point, you know, do I pursue this? Do I stay in what seems to be a more safe option, or do I take a risk and go somewhere else and see what waits? And so it took me a couple of months to really think about it. And Karen was very patient, and I'm very grateful for that. And in 2014, I started working with Karen at Tranexec. So that was, again, one of the best decisions that I've made. I really flourished in that organization. I was hugely challenged.
It's where my facilitation skills have really ramped up. There was no hiding because I was just there having to facilitate. So I had to learn very quickly and soon helped to grow the business by bringing in more coaches and becoming the head of coaching at Tranexec for a few years. And that saw me travel the world. We worked in India, as you mentioned, and the UK, Hong Kong as well. And so there was a very exciting time there where I was jet setting around the world and around the country, you know, certainly traveling a lot and doing work that I loved. I will also add that it was quite high pressure from a travel perspective and having the children at home and not having other family in Sydney and having to try to find care for them when both my husband and I were busy. So, you know, if I was away, and he might have been away as well, he is a very talented musician and he was traveling also overseas and around the country. So there were times where we were both away and we had to find a solution for that. So it was definitely a balancing act at that point, but certainly a very exciting time in my life. And I'm really happy to say that I'm still very much associated with Tranexec.
Is Kati Kapailad. Episode 39.
And I worked in a job that was, I had the most amazing opportunity to work in a role that actually had regional responsibilities, which meant I was regularly traveling and moving to different places, working with different, you know, cultures, different countries. And I was working in a for-purpose area. So I was working in education and bringing people together from an educational perspective across Europe, North Africa, Central Asia. So I was traveling around in those countries and understanding how people worked, what the differences were, what the similarities were, how we could make their lives better if we could, and, you know, work to do that. So that was part of my early early career, and that probably was one of the reasons why I married probably later than I would have normally had I been in a different environment, because I was traveling a lot, I was doing a lot of things. I didn't marry in my 20s, I married in my 30s, which is the case now, but it wasn't 20 years ago. And so that has definitely, that travel and working with people at an international level has shaped a lot of my journeys. And I always tend to show up with that as a perspective.
Okay. And so when you've been focusing on the understanding the differences and similarities between different people, like obviously you were putting the passion that you had towards these projects above the normal path that most people would take, right? Most people, they're settling in one spot, they find a spouse, they get married, they have kids, and they kind of try and work at their career a little bit, and then they kind of just juggle life and life and work. And you kind of decided, you know what, everything career and purpose, because this is my passion, this is where I'm going. Was there more to it that kept you in that environment, or was it just, was there a bit of a fear of getting married as well, like of settling down, given how free you'd been until that point? What else was driving that?
There was definitely a fear of being stuck in a place, not necessarily marriage, but when I was in finishing my degrees here in Australia, I could see everyone around me and where their path was going. And it's pretty much exactly as you described, getting your first job, putting money down for your first house, getting your car, then getting married, then having children, getting your second car, getting your second mortgage perhaps, and moving forward with that. And I could see it pretty much right in front of me, and it didn't excite me. I wanted something that was more exciting than that. And I felt that what I wanted to do was, and what I was capable of doing was more than that. I'm not diminishing that at all, but I felt like I had more to give before I did that. And that's what really drove me to go overseas and travel. And as I said to you, I was incredibly lucky to have this opportunity with this job that also didn't keep me in one place. Even overseas, I was really traveling and doing a lot of things overseas and, you know, working with governments in other jurisdictions, that is a challenge in itself. I didn't speak all those languages. As you can imagine, it's 20 countries. I didn't speak all those languages. So it was challenging. And I felt like I wanted that. And I felt good with that. That's not for everyone. And I'm not suggesting it is for everyone. I think that stability is amazing. But as I mentioned earlier, my sense of stability and belonging is probably different to most people's. And my parameters for discomfort are wider as well. So I'm comfortable in a bigger field than most people are, because I've lived a situation and I've lived a journey so far, at least, that has pushed me into areas. So I'm okay with discomfort a lot more than I've noticed that here at work as well. With uncertainty and discomfort, I'm a lot more comfortable with that than many people that I see around me.
Here's Tina Comrie from episode 43.
I happily share some of these stories with especially my junior staff now, because it's important that they know that everybody makes mistakes and that mistakes are they're not life and death. We're in media, we're in marketing. It's never life or death. Sure, it can be very expensive and it can seem like the end of the world to somebody who's in this, especially in the junior phases of their career. But one of the biggest, earliest mistakes that I made was I signed off and let Lorem Ipsum go to print on the cover. For those of you who aren't designers or in the media space, Lorem Ipsum is that placeholder language that literally means nothing. It's just what graphic designers use to hold place for a headline.
It's like the thing when you try to set up a website and there's this Lorem Ipsum. Yeah, okay.
Yeah, correct.
You had that on the front cover, did you?
Yeah. Yeah, just in one little place, I had missed completing it with a headline, and it had gone through like 7 or 8 different people. How on earth nobody else picked it up? But I was the final, the buck stopped with me and I signed it off. Never mind all the other people that could have, should have, the people at the printers, the, you know, the print rep, Tim, anybody else that worked at the magazine, nobody else picked it up. But because I signed it off, it was definitely my mistake. And because it was a quarterly magazine, it was on shelves for 3 months. And every time I saw it in a newsstand or a supermarket, I was devastated. So embarrassing. It was there for the whole public, everyone to see. So yeah, that was a pretty big one. And that was just all about taking care of the details. That was the lesson in that.
Yeah, well, look, this actually kind of sounds, it reminds me of something which we've spoken about in the past. Which is this idea that when people are posting up on social media or most things that they do in their life, when it suddenly comes onto the public forum, people feel like, oh no, like I've got to get this absolutely right. What if this goes viral? But there aren't that many things that actually go viral, right, on social media. And even if it does, well, great, it's gone viral with a mistake, but at least it's gone viral, which most people haven't been able to. Is that a similar lesson that you're sharing now as well?
Yeah, so I guess I can look at it from two ways. One being that something that goes viral digitally is easily fixable. I mean, you can pull it down, you can delete it, you can edit it, you can fix your mistakes online. Pre that, you could not. I had to live with my mistake in print for all to see for months and months. And, you know, being, you know, now we are in an agency environment where some clients sweat the details so hard about the finest little things, which in fact, almost nobody will pay attention to aside from you yourself. So there's a little bit of what we call Gitmo, which is good enough to move on, especially in the land of social media, where you really have to, you know, if you're publishing something every day or several times a week, and there does need to be a level of, hey, just this is good enough to move on from this now. Don't sweat the details. But it still needs to be grammatically on point.
So I hope you received a whole lot of value from engaging in that conversation. What were the key takeaways for you? What can you schedule in your life right now to make sure that the time you just invested into listening to this exceptional conversation with this amazing mentor and this amazing individual is time that wasn't misused, but was time that you've allocated properly to enhancing your life and improving it? Whatever it is, schedule it now, practice it now. Be the successful person you're meant to be. Live with purpose.